Hi, welcome to Qubits, your bite-sized pieces of quantum computing. My name is Renee from Valorum Reply, and today we're going to talk about updates from the quantum computing hardware landscape. And for this, I'm very honored to have a special expert guest and fellow Microsoft MVP and Microsoft Regional Director, Ciprian Cici. Hi, Ciprian, and welcome to the show. How are you today?
Hi, I'm good. I'm very excited to come back to your show. Thank you very much for having me. And of course, the topic is a very, very interesting one, because I think every month we see some new announcements and things are really getting hot in this space.
Yeah. Before we start, for folks that might not have seen you in the previous episodes, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your background and what you're doing with quantum?
Oh, absolutely. One of my primary areas of work is leading the advanced computing practice at Soliance. Soliance is one of the Microsoft global partners. Among many things, I do a lot of quantum computing related work over there, mostly in the space of advisory, but also lately we have been involved in projects related to post-quantum cryptography, the security, impact of new quantum computers, as well as a couple of interesting projects where we explore using quantum computing to solve optimization problems. I like to call myself a failed physicist, in a sense that 25 years ago when I started my career, I had to choose between physics and computer science. I chose computer science, but interestingly enough, fast forward 25 years, I find myself again working in both areas. So this is really, really exciting. Awesome. And as you mentioned, I'm a Microsoft most valuable professional for AI and for quantum computing, which is very exciting because it allows us to work directly with the Microsoft quantum team.
Yeah. And also, don't forget to tell our audience here that you're also giving a course at a university, right?
Yeah, this is something new. It's also very, very exciting. This fall, I started an Introduction to Quantum Computing course at my local university in Timișoara in Romania. And I can tell you, I was really surprised about the level of interest that we see among the students. It's not only that the interest exists in the industry, but it seems the interest exists in the education space, which is very, very encouraging for me, I have to say.
Yeah, it's really impressive. In fact, for this season six here, which we're recording right now, for episode one, I interviewed a student from the US, and she started with quantum when she was 15 years old. Like, it's just, and super excited about it. So it's really something that, you know, the young folks are very eager to learn.
And yeah, it's very interesting that you say, because I think 2 or 3 months ago, on the podcast that I do as well on quantum computing, we had a guest who was teaching an introduction to quantum computing in one of the high schools in New York. So it's not only that you see it in university, right? You start seeing, obviously, the level is kind of dialed down to allow kids from high school to understand the concepts. But this is actually, Renee, what I call the quantum first generation, right? All of us, including me and you, we have this bias of classical computing because that's where we have grown up, right? But we see more and more this generation who actually has, like, its first contact ever with computing in the form of quantum computing. And that will be an interesting generation to watch probably in the coming decade.
Absolutely. And yeah, like you mentioned, you also run a podcast together with Patrick Hines called Entangled Things, right?
Yeah.
Awesome. So check this out too, folks. So we have some good two podcasts here. I mean, there are a few more, but the best ones is Entangled Things and Qubits, of course. So check those out. All right. Well, let's get started with some of the questions. And, you know, in season two, episode two, we talked about what kind of different quantum computers are out there and, you know, different kind of approaches for for, you know, building the qubits, You know, I keep on saying qubits, but for realizing the qubits, and you know, which were the most promising ones in your opinion? And so this was in February 2021, which is quite a while, 1.5 years ago. And so, yeah, what has changed since then? Any good stuff there?
Well, from my point of view, I believe we see a consolidation in the top two modalities that yield, let's say, the highest quality practical results today. And I'm talking here about trapped ion and the superconducting approach. We've seen a couple of releases of new chips in this space, and also we've seen a very interesting development with respect to Microsoft's topological quantum computing approach, which first had a major setback back in 2018-2019, right? But it seemed they recovered in a very significant way. I think IBM launched recently their 433-qubit processor, which, just to be accurate, these are physical qubits. But it's interesting because my IBM has this kind of timeline that they put forward where they expect to get close to 1,000 qubits in 2023 and then go as high as maybe 2,000 to 3,000 qubits in 2024, 2025. So I would say we are starting to get a little bit of clarity in terms of these modalities. The ones that are like have practical results, as I mentioned, are the superconducting modality as well as the trapped ion one. Microsoft has proved that their modality, which is based on the topological approach, has at least now some validation, both in theory and practice. Mm-hmm. And then also we've seen some interesting developments in what I call, let's say, alternative modalities, like, for instance, the nitrogen vacancies in diamonds, which they provide a very, very interesting type of qubit that plays on defects that exist in diamonds, where you see basically a carbon atom being replaced by a nitrogen atom plus a vacancy near that, which are, in fact, the more like stable types of qubits. Unfortunately, they are very, very difficult to manufacture. Manufacturing at this level defects in diamonds seems to be extremely complicated. And last but not least, we also see a confirmation, René, of the immense challenge of scaling up, both for the superconducting qubits as well as for the trapped ions ones. We see time and time again that moving from a small number of logical qubits up to a high number of logical qubits proves to be extremely challenging in terms of the engineering involved.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, like you're saying, IBM is really pushing forward, like with the highest qubit numbers, but it's all noisy qubits or like physical qubits. How much do you think is actually required to make a logical qubit that is more a little bit more stable? Like what is practical usable if you have a 1,000 qubit computer?
Well, at this point, we still see some, let's say, quite significant error rates. It seems that they range somewhere at the level of 10 at the power of minus 3 to 10 at the power of minus 2, which means you will still need thousands of physical qubits, thousands to hundreds of physical qubits to get logical qubits. But the interesting thing, I had also another guest, a professor who is focused on error correction in the space of circuit-based quantum computing. And what he told us was very interesting. He said that 2022 and 2023 will mark the tipping point of quantum error correction becoming a positive factor in quantum computing. Like up to this point, right, any type of error correction that you were attempting actually required more noisy qubits, and the noise of those physical qubits actually contributed to decreasing the quality of the computation. It seems that the level of stability of qubits has reached a point, or will reach very soon, a point where error correction will actually start correcting the errors and not contribute to the decrease of stability of the whole system. Obviously, we're still very far from like super stable logical qubits based on error correction, but nevertheless, I believe this is a remarkable point of inflection in the evolution of both the hardware and the error correction codes that have been proposed. And the other interesting thing about this is we start to have a couple of interesting proposals now that would do error correction in quantum computing bits without codes. And that's, again, quite an interesting approach. Like the classical standard kind of classical computing inspired approach is to use codes, but we also see alternatives. So I think there are a lot of things that are moving in this space. And I believe we are on the path of seeing a better ratio of logical qubits to physical qubits required to produce them.
Got it. Yeah, that's actually a really exciting development. And you also mentioned, you know, that there are different approaches where you can have more stable qubits. And we already mentioned Microsoft and their approach with the topological qubits, which is meant to be more stable. And they're leveraging something, but you also mentioned they had this breakthrough with this, what is called Majorana zero modes. Can you explain what it is and why it's such an important milestone, in fact?
Sure. Microsoft's approach is a very interesting one in a sense that it is unique. It's neither based on the classical superconducting approach nor based on the trapped ion approach. Essentially, what they are building there, if we like oversimplify the whole thing, right? They are building some what we call topological superconducting wires, which are like very, very narrow, like super narrow areas of material that have the superconducting capabilities, but they also exist in a very specific state of matter, which is called the topological state of matter. Without getting into the details, this is essentially a state of matter where matter behaves more like in a 2D style rather than a 3D style. And you can imagine that it's more stable, right? It's easier to keep the stability. So imagine these wires, right? And then at the end of these wires, they have these energy gaps, which can act as qubits. These are the so-called MZMs, or the Majorana zero modes. And what actually Microsoft was able to prove earlier this year was that the gap between these spikes, these Majorana zero modes, right, was around 30 microelectron volts, which, like, the number in itself is not interesting, maybe. What's interesting is this is actually three times larger than the average noise in the experimental environment, which means, in plain English, these Majorana zero modes that they found seems to be very well isolated from the background noise of the system, which is one of the fundamental problems that all modalities, all quantum computing building modalities have to deal with. This is why the result is remarkable. But the other thing that I would like to point out is after the setback that Microsoft had circa 2018, 2019, what they did this time was truly remarkable. They actually published all their experimental results. There is, in fact, a notebook that anyone can download that contains a huge data set with all the experimental results. So the results are peer-reviewed. Anyone can download the results, do the scrutiny on them, potentially even refute some of the claims that Microsoft did. And this is something that no other a company that is involved in building quantum computers today has done with their experimental research data. And I find this truly remarkable. And also it's a very important step because it seems it's not a unique kind of case. It seems this is a major shift in Microsoft's strategy. And according to what they say, they plan to continue releasing their experimental results. So it's encouraging because if you think about superconducting and trapped ions, those were the, I dare to call, low-hanging fruits, the obvious approaches. The topological superconducting wires were the not-so-obvious one, and much higher risk is involved in building this. However, if Microsoft manages to build a stable qubit based on these, then their path to scaling up, I mean, from 100 qubits to 1,000 to 10,000, I expect it to be smoother than in the case of the other modalities. So it's very exciting, and I'm really watching like the evolutions here. This is very encouraging news, not for Microsoft necessarily, but for the whole quantum computing ecosystem. Any type of these breakthroughs is really, really exciting.
Yeah, awesome. And like you're saying, it's even open source, right? So all the folks can build on top of this. And we've seen it with AI in the last couple of years, where a lot of the research of with AI models was then open sourced rather quickly. And that helps the whole community and, you know, the whole industry to move forward rather quickly. So yeah, really, really good stuff there.
Indeed. It's, I mean, Microsoft, we all know, is essentially a platform company, right? So while they are driving their, let's say, hardware kind of quest, almost in parallel, actually in parallel, they are building a full stack, which ranges from the capability of incorporating third-party hardware, like, for example, IonQ chips and so forth, right? All the way to building simulators, to building estimators for quantum resources, programming languages as Q-sharp, SDKs on top of that, and full environments, as you mentioned, which contribute to disseminating the ideas of quantum computing. So now you can choose the Microsoft way or you can choose the IBM way, right? But what at the end of the day, what's important is if you want to start learning programming in quantum computing, you already have these kinds of environments where you can start testing your ideas, your algorithms, which is great.
So you can actually run a bunch of simulations as well, right? In fact, I was also talking with Jin from NVIDIA, the author for another episode here. He's the developer relations manager at NVIDIA. And, you know, he mentioned a couple of things, but also interestingly, and I think I saw it actually at GDC, at NVIDIA GDC before, they also have these huge, DGX A100 systems, like crazy large GPU systems, basically. And they were able to do this, I think it's called a super pod. So basically you need a lot of resources, of course, a lot of GPUs, and they can simulate 5,000 qubits, stable qubits, of course, because it's a simulation. But this is also something similar that Microsoft is also offering with the simulation there, right? And you can already get started with quite a lot of qubits, in fact.
And also, I think it's important because we're talking about building like modalities to build quantum computers. We should not forget to mention some important advancements that D-Wave is making. Compared to the other one that we mentioned, D-Wave is building quantum computers for adiabatic quantum computing, which is a different kind of approach, right? Yeah. But they are already in the realm of, I believe, the latest one that they announced is 4,000 qubits for adiabatic quantum computing and increasing. Now, these are more specialized types of hardware, which are super kind of geared towards solving optimization problems. But nevertheless, the level of scale is also impressive. So in this field, I think D-Wave is also doing some remarkable work, and they are moving fast towards what they kind of stated as to be one of their like first big milestone goals, the 10,000 qubit chip for adiabatic quantum computing. And I have to say, they are fighting like the same types of battles in terms of cooling down the chips, in terms of scaling up, right? One of the big problems of scaling, by the way, is providing the connections between the qubits, right? It's easy to apply like single qubit gates to those qubits. Your problems start when you need to apply two qubit gates to them, because then you are starting to depend on the topology of the connections between the qubits. And in today's chips, right, not all pairs of qubits can actually be subject to two qubit gates, which is a significant limitation in terms of how you implement your algorithms in a practical way. So this is also a fascinating kind of aspect of the building of the hardware. There's so many things that you need to address, not only like cooling down and getting to insane levels of, let's say, finesse in terms of how you engineer those things, but also like the topology of the connections is a fascinating problem these folks need to address.
No, absolutely. And I was actually also, again, we are just recently for another episode talking with a quantum chemistry, chemistress, I don't know how you say it, but, you know, someone that works in chemistry. And in fact, they are using also D-Wave systems for drug discovery. So they're doing like the initial phases with certain protein kind of, you know, analysis and doing all of this already on D-Wave because, you know, for their purpose, it actually works quite well. And they are much faster. And she told me they can also build things like personalized medicine and all of this stuff, which is really interesting, a visionary topic that is, of course, going to happen in a couple of years. But they already can do this now. And she said, basically, with their approach, they're able to do the initial phase of drug discovery, which previously has been taking like a few years, like 4 years usually. And they can do this in 6 months or less. And especially if you think about like personalized medicine, like this could save the life of a person, right? So this is impressive, I think, and really, really impactful.
It's amazing, yeah.
Yeah. You mentioned already a bunch of players that are researching and developing quantum computers. Anyone that we missed?
Well, the list, fortunately, is fairly it's fairly long, right? Obviously, we would have to mention here Rigetti. It's another, like we used to call it like startup, but it's been already for quite a number of times, right? And then the spin-off that resulted from Honeywell, which is called Quantinuum, is another very, very interesting player in the field. IonQ is another one that I've already mentioned. But I think also we see the likes of Toshiba and Intel. And again, without intentionally leaving anyone out, the field starts to attract more and more like high profile names, because now that the industry starts seeing some practical results, as you mentioned, with optimization processes actually being run on adiabatic quantum computing, circuit-based quantum computing processors becoming larger than 5 qubits, what we used to have like a few years ago, right? Now you see this interest starting to increase, and I believe we will see more and more of these let's say involvements. And what's also very important here is you see a lot of combinations, right, or collaborations between these private companies and the academic space, right? We have some of the major universities of the world running either quantum computing programs or having entire departments. And this is also very, very, very important. So it's refreshing to see that we have like options. We still have like to be, let's say, on the non-hype side, we still have a long way to go. Mm-hmm. We're not yet at the point of breaking RSA 2048, just to be clear on that. A lot of investment still needs to be made. I would dare to say a lot of innovation still needs to happen, but the field is moving, and the field is moving at a very, very fast pace. And at the end of the day, right, no matter how many smart algorithms design if we will not have the chips, the physical devices to run those things on. They will be at the end of the day useless. One other interesting topic or modality that we haven't talked about, we see some interesting initiatives in terms of creating some types of qubit systems that will run at higher temperatures, right? And when I, just to keep things in perspective, right, when I say higher, like the current ones are run at usually tens of millikelvins. In terms of relative comparison, the coldest place that we know of in the universe is around 3 Kelvin. So running stuff at 30 millikelvin means you need to run stuff at about 100 times cooler temperature than the coolest place in the universe. So these are like remarkable devices. These other approaches that I'm talking about are trying to implement what we call like room temperature qubits, but they're not really room temperature, but they will run probably at 5 to 10 Kelvin. So that's also an very interesting line of work, because today to reach those temperatures of tens of millikelvins, the infrastructure required is extremely complex. And then the coherence times of those qubits are very, very short lived. So this is another interesting kind of challenge. And these propositions of increasing the temperature at which those qubits live are very, very important. The higher the temperature you have, right, essentially the more movement you get in your system, so the more noise you get. Yep. And obviously the ideal would be at some point one can always dream, right? We might have qubits that actually work at room temperature, but we don't even know if that will ever be possible.
Yeah. Well, that was fantastic, Cyprian. Thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your insights. Again, it was fantastic to hear all about it. Very much appreciated. Thank you so much.
Thank you very, very much for having me on the show. It was a real pleasure, as always.
Awesome. Well, and thanks everyone for joining us for yet another episode of Qubites, your bite-sized pieces of quantum computing. Watch our blog, follow our social media channels to hear all about the next episodes. And of course, subscribe to our YouTube if you want to get a notification when the next episode is available. And you can, of course, watch all the previous episodes, including season 2, episode 2 with Cyprian and all the other guests. You can find them all on the website. Thank you so much. Take care and see you soon. Bye-bye.